Good afternoon. As you can see, Justice Pickering is participating in today's argument in Las Vegas. The rest of us, of course, are here. This is the time set for argument on case number 88813, Uber Sexual Assault Survivors et al. Versus Uber Technologies, Inc. et al. Okay. I think, well, you're probably familiar with how we've been doing our en banc arguments this year, but each side not only gets sort of the standard 15 minutes per side, but we've added an extra 2 minutes per side at the beginning uninterrupted. So a total of 17 minutes that you will each have on your respective clocks as they count down. So the first 2 minutes will be uninterrupted. With that, for the appellants, are you dividing your time? Or are you?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Then would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please. Thank you.
And so what will happen is the clock will be counting down. When it gets to 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on and you'll hear the tone. But as long as you're still up there, the clock is still counting down. And if it gets to zero, you're out of time. Okay.
Good afternoon.
With that, please proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. Deepak Gupta for the appellants. This Court's precedents have consistently emphasized the importance of the description of effect in preventing voter confusion and in promoting informed decisions. At a minimum, proponents must tell voters what they're proposing, how their proposal works, and what its main effects are. The uncontested factual record here demonstrates that this initiative would dramatically reduce access to legal representation in Nevada to a degree that is unprecedented anywhere else in the country, would deprive Nevada's Medicaid fund and other critical state programs of millions of dollars annually, and would displace this court's traditional role in regulating attorney's fees under the rules of professional conduct. Yet you wouldn't know any of that from reading the description of effect. But perhaps the most remarkable defect, and the one I want to focus on now, is that the initiative's sponsor admits that it doesn't know how its own initiative works. At pages 37 and 38 of its brief, Uber expressly acknowledges that the meaning of recovery, which it concedes is integral to the central issue in this initiative, is, quote, not at all clear and not predictable at this moment. And this is no mere technical flaw. The initiative asks voters to approve a 20% cap without telling them what that percentage would actually be calculated against. This is like asking the voters to approve a 20% tax without telling them 20% of what. If Uber can't explain to this court how its own initiative works, how could voters possibly have made an informed choice about whether to sign this petition? And the description itself compounds this problem by inviting voters to make what they will think is an apples-to-apples comparison to existing law without realizing that current law uses a different definition of recovery. And that's not just a description problem, it's a fatal flaw with the initiative itself. Signatures were gathered for an initiative that Uber now concedes is not at all clear on an integral and central issue. We can't go back in time and tell the people who signed this petition at the grocery store parking lot what the initiative means. If the petition requirements are to mean anything, they must mean that voters understand what they're being asked to sign at the time that they're asked to sign it. I welcome the court's questions.
So, Mr. Gupta, then, how would you respond to their argument that those are, you know, legal questions to be settled later? This is the preliminary stage of an initiative such as this, and those substantive issues are to be resolved later. How would you respond?
Yeah, I think this court's jurisprudence has been clear that what you don't engage in an initiative litigation challenge is hypothetical constitutional adjudication or hypothetical statutory interpretation. And I think a good case, a seminal case to look to for that is the Herbst Gaming case. But I think that's a point in our favor, not a point in their favor, because they've acknowledged, and this is unusual here, they've acknowledged that the central issue about how this initiative works can't be determined. And so they can't describe how it works in the description because they don't know and they won't tell us. And so the fact that this court can't now hear engage in statutory interpretation under cases like Herbst Gaming is actually, I think, a very strong point in our favor, because it means that the problem, that the situation that we're now in, can't be cured. As I said, you can't go back in time and tell those people who signed this what it meant. They've acknowledged the ambiguity. And so I think this is a case in which, under precedents like Education Freedom Pack versus Reed, you can conclude that the description of effect here is inadequate, that the initiative is therefore void, and that it cannot proceed. And you could stop there. I think you could do that, as we suggested in our brief, without breaking any new legal ground under this court's precedent. You could even do it in an unpublished order. Of course, we have a lot of other defects that we think are important to discuss today, but I think that is the most straightforward one, because this is an unusual situation in which the proponents of the initiative have acknowledged that they can't tell us how it works. And this is not, you know, this is a problem we raised in our complaint. We raised it in our papers in the district court. We raised it in the hearing at the district court. We raised it in our briefs to this court. And the response has been consistently to say, it's not clear, that would require future judicial interpretation. And that might be an answer if you had the kind of situation that I think the court was concerned with in Helton, which is, look, challengers can always, lawyers are clever, they can always say, you know, there's something that you didn't tell us, or there's some hypothetical, or some, lawyers are always good at spotting ambiguities. And so obviously you can't have, if we want the initiative process to mean something and there's a constitutional right to propose initiatives, we can't have a situation in which lawyers are spinning out those hypotheticals. But that's not what's going on here. This is an issue that they have acknowledged is central and integral to the initiative. It's, as I said, it's you can't even know 20% of what unless you know the answer. And we also submitted unrebutted declarations from lawyers across the state who show, using numbers from their own practice, how critical this effect is. That in effect what it does in the vast majority of the sort of garden variety injury cases is to take what looks like a 20% cap and actually bump it down to what could be a 10% cap or even a lower cap. So this isn't some incidental, peripheral kind of thing of the kind of speculation that I think the court was concerned with in Helton. Helton also emphasized the difference between unsupported speculation and the need for challengers to come forward with evidence in the district court. I think that's why the legislature, when it crafted the statute for these challenges, located the challenge in the first instance in the district court and said the challenger has to come forward within 15 days and attach the declarations and documents on which the challenge is based. That recognizes, I think, on the legislature's part, that there's going to be a need for factual development. And this court has consistently recognized that in Las Vegas Taxpayer, in Helton, and then again this year in the Fair Maps case. I think that was the real fight in the Fair Maps case was, you know, was there enough evidence in the district court to show that if you created this new body, that you're going to have to pay people? And I think part of the way I read that decision is you all relied to some degree on common sense, but you also said, look, you make the record in the district court. There was evidence in the district court showing this effect, and the problem was that the challengers didn't make any objections. They didn't fight those facts, and that's what you have here. We made a robust, detailed record with expert reports, with declarations from lawyers across the state showing the kinds of effects that I just recited, as well as the significance of this problem with the definition of recovery. And the response on the other side was to say, well, that's not relevant, and we're not going to engage on the facts. And I do think the district court recognized something important. The district court recognized in its order that we had made strong arguments about all of these effects. Where I think the district court went wrong, in a way that I think is at odds with this court's precedent, is to say that wasn't germane, those effects weren't germane. But if you accept that we have established those effects, a substantial fiscal effect, a drain on the state's treasury, evidence about the main effect of what this proposal would do, evidence about the displacement of the judiciary's role and what that would mean, and evidence about how this definition of recovery would work. If you accept that we presented evidence on those things and that they were uncontested, then this is not a difficult case, because all you have to do, I think, is run the uncontested factual record through the precedents, and any one of those things independently would be a basis to declare this initiative void.
Well, Mr. Gupta, you would acknowledge that at this stage of the case, it's not our function, and we're not opining on whether we think this is a good idea or a bad idea, or whether it would have good or bad effects.
Absolutely, that's right. I think this court has been clear that the policy merits are not for the court to decide. This court is not an appropriate forum to decide.
I got the feeling, I think that's what the district court's concern was, that he didn't want to be stepping over into, because some of the evidence presented may be part of an argument that about whether or not the initiative should be passed.
Right.
And the judge was being careful not to get involved in that dispute, appropriately
yeah.
so.
I think that was a legitimate concern on the district court's part, and it would be a legitimate concern on this court's part. But the medicine is too strong, because it's always going to be the case that when you're talking about what the effects of a proposal are, that's going to overlap to some degree with the eventual debate that somebody might have about the wisdom of a policy. But I think we can separate out those two things, and I think this court's jurisprudence does a good job of separating out those two things. So if you just take fiscal effects, for example, this court has been very clear, and I think the Education Freedom Pact versus Reed case is very clear about this, that the proponent, if there is a substantial fiscal effect, and that the challengers, it's the burden on us to show that there is, but once that's established, the proponent has to have revealed that effect in the description of effect. Now, it's true that when there's a political fight about an initiative, people are also going to battle over what those effects are and what the voters should think of it. But that doesn't mean that the court abdicates its role, the role that the legislature has assigned to it, to police the description of effect. And again, I'll just go back to what I started with. The reason this all matters is because the court is in a role of policing the process to ensure that voters are not misled or confused. And so that role is necessarily going to entail looking at arguments about what the effect of a proposal are. But we're not saying that this description, you know, the description would have been satisfactory if it had said, you know, this will have a corresponding effect on the state Medicaid fund. That doesn't mean that voters couldn't vote for it. You know, they're welcome to propose something that has a fiscal effect, and then the voters would decide. The court has never said that it abdicates its role in policing the description of effect for that reason.
Can I ask a quick question just turning our attention to the full text of the measure proposed requirement? It's your position that they would have to present all implicitly supplanted statutes or otherwise impacted statutes. I don't know that if the constitutional requirement goes that far, but what makes you think it was, I don't believe I saw any authority pointing to that we could look to that says what you're proposing.
Yeah, I would say, first of all, I would say, Your Honor, that's not our lead argument, and I'll acknowledge that the jurisprudence is not an understatement to say not fleshed out on this requirement, but it's there in the Constitution. It has come up in recent challenges. And I think our argument, if I understand your question correctly, is more modest than what you described, because I think it would be too onerous for a petition, particularly a complex petition, to kind of hunt through the Nevada revised statutes and hunt for everything that could be implicitly implicated. But that's not the case here. Here, there are three things that are implicated, and we all know what they are, and the description actually alludes to them, right? They are the cap, the existing cap for medical malpractice, the existing cap for cases involving the state, and Rule 1.5 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. And let me just take the medical malpractice cap for a moment, because I think that illustrates the importance of the requirement. Because if you saw the definition of recovery in the medical malpractice statute alongside the definition that's being proposed here, it would be immediately apparent that what the drafters have done is borrowed the language from that existing statute and removed half the definition. And that's not a small thing. It's a deliberate choice. And we all know, at least us lawyers and judges know, that when a drafter of a legal document does that, that has some effect, or that's interpreted to have some effect.
Well, if they would have included that in their description of effect, would you agree then they would not necessarily have to then present the full text of the measure on the Medicaid caps?
No, I'm not sure about the interaction between the two requirements. As I understand it, the description of effect is a freestanding requirement from the constitutional requirement. But let me just take your hypothetical. If they had acknowledged this drafting change and said something about it in the description of effect, they would have then had to do what they have so far refused to do, which is to tell us what it means and how it works. And I can't really draft for them what that would look like because I'm not quite sure what their position is. But I think it would be something, you know, fairly simple, which is this initiative changes how recovery is calculated by requiring medical costs to be subtracted before applying the percentage. You know, but we don't know. And it's, you know, respectfully, like, it's not our job to read their minds and figure out what they intended. We placed this issue front and center in the complaint and in the district court, in the hearing in the district court, in our briefs to this court. And I think this is an unusual situation where it shows the wisdom of what this court said 20 years ago in Herbst Gaming, which is, you know, you don't engage in premature or statutory adjudication. I do want to make sure I save some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schrager. And you know how the clock works. You'll get your tone and yellow light when it gets to 5 minutes.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Bradley Schrager for respondents. We are here today, as so many times before, to resolve appropriate pre-election questions of a ballot measure petition's legal sufficiency. I say appropriate questions because, as you read and as you've now heard, appellants have what I consider to be mostly policy disagreements with the substance of the measure, or second or third order speculation regarding its potential effects. Each of those are anathema to this court's analysis at this time. Those are presently not up for debate. Now, appellants are free to harbor intense opposition to the petition. They are free to firmly believe it will have deleterious effects. They are, most importantly, free to conduct a full-throated political public campaign against its enactment. They are not free, however, to force their policy disagreements into respondents' petition, which more than 200,000 Nevadans have signed, has been qualified by the Secretary of State, and is scheduled to be transmitted to the Nevada legislature at its opening. The questions here today are confined to, have proponents complied with their legal responsibilities to confine themselves to a single subject, to provide a description that is succinct and non-argumentative, and have they complied with Article 19's full text requirement? Appellant's burden is to show not only that respondents have failed to do that, but that the measure is clearly invalid. Now, this petition is among the cleanest and simplest this court has encountered. So the task today, which is applying the analytical steps this court has always adhered to in order to facilitate the people's initiative rights, is not on its face particularly difficult. So let's go through it. And I don't want to assume that because it wasn't mentioned that appellants have abandoned their single subject arguments. So I want to start with that, if I may, because I also think it's probably the quickest way through this thicket. The single subject test is a familiar one by now. It has been clarified over the years, but it most recently in both Washington and in Hilton. And it goes something like this. Are all of its provisions functionally related and germane to the petition's purpose and to each other? To do that, this court first determines the measure's purpose, its subject. It does that by reference to the petition's text and to the arguments made by the proponents. Here, as argued below, as argued here in our papers, and as accepted by the district court, the clear purpose of this petition is the limitation of contingency fees in civil cases. I don't see that it could be anything other than that from the face of the petition. And clearly I don't see that that appellants have suggested that there's any other primary purpose. Having determined that, the test then moves to the relationship between that purpose and each of the provisions of the petition.
Mr. Schrager, can I actually turn your attention to the description of effect? You know, frequently we have these, it's addressed as they only have 200 words.
Yeah.
So you only had 200 words. You used about 100. So you used about half that, and you didn't include the word net. Which net, like net recovery, yeah. Which is in the statute, but not in the description of effect.
Which is in which statute, Your Honor?
Which is in your recovered, the net sum recovered, yeah. The definition of recovered, but it's not in your description of effect.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's a one word that has consequence, at least, or has consequence to the effect of a 20% contingency fee. So how would you address that?
Well, it seems to me that the petition itself is short and succinct, and people who have the petition before them are presumed to be able to read it, right? They're actually required to have it handed to them. It's short, it's easy, the word net is there. The fact that that doesn't appear in the description of effect, I don't think it invalidates the description of effect, right? The description of effect says...
Schrager, it also can't be deceptive or misleading. That's part of the rested at sentence, right, about it being short and, you know, succinct and non-argumentative.
Succinct, non-argumentative.
And not deceptive or misleading.
Or misleading.
Right.
So the question would the lack of the word net render it misleading?
Or something of similar import.
Something of similar import. Well,
after cost, after disbursements, there are multiple ways to get that point across.
Right. And so the question is, does it have to be in both places?
Right.
I mean, if we assume that someone reading the petition...
What do you mean? Sorry. What do you mean both places?
Being both in the text in the description of effect.
Well, that was your client's choice to put it in the text.
Absolutely.
But if it's in the text, does it need to be in the description of effect?
I don't think so. Look, this is one of the shortest petitions this court has ever seen before, right? I mean, if you look at the petition in Helsin, it was 15 pages long. If you look at the petitions in Washington, it was several pages long, right, with many, many subsections. I don't think you could have held those petitioners to that same standard, that the appearance of the word net in the statute must be in the description of effect or it renders it misleading. I think that you have to be able to assume that the description of effect is an aid in understanding the text of
the petition.
Well, the
question is it misleading to say, when you say in the description of effect that it's 20% of any amount or amounts recovered, is that misleading without the something to say that that 20% is after costs, which may or may not include medical expenses?
Well, that actually gets us into the interplay between that and the current statute, which is important, and I want to get to that. But clearly, in the petition itself, it has a definition of the term recovered, right, which says very clearly, recovered means the net sum recovered by the plaintiff or plaintiffs after deducting any disbursements or costs incurred in connection with the prosecution or settlement of the claim.
Right.
That strikes me as an incredibly simple set of propositions, right? A simple set of concepts. The description of effect doesn't lead anyone away from that. It certainly doesn't mislead you that there won't be recovery or that it won't be 20%.
That's a question. Does 20% of any amount or amounts recovered lead people to think it's the full amount that you may recover from a would-be defendant?
Well, when the petition itself defines recovery, and the description uses the word recovered, and both of them are essentially brief, I think that one can assume that in aid of understanding all of it, petition signatories, the people, are going to read them all, right? You have to assume that. That's a fiction by which we live. So I don't think that the absence of the word net can invalidate the entire petition that is entirely simple in every other respect. Okay.
So, Mr. Schrager, though, do you think that from the petition and the description that it would be clear to someone that there's a change being made to how statutes have defined recovery?
Yeah.
Because to me, that's a concern, that it is not clear that the law is being changed in that regard. It looks like it's just capping attorney's fees and not changing anything else.
Yeah. I want to make clear a basic disagreement I have with the premise and with a balance argument, which is that there is no direct change of 7095. Anytime the legislature passes a statute, and this is why I take issue with the notion that, well, they don't know how it's going to work. What they argued below was, you didn't tell us that you were repealing 7095. Now, any time the legislature passes a statute that may interact with any other statute, there are ways in which, judicially, we confront that issue, right? We don't assume an automatic repeal. We first ask, is there an express repeal? Now, if anyone who would argue that there's an express repeal, nobody mentioned 7095. There's no direct reference to it. So there's no express repeal. So all right, then what does a judge do after that? Well, as we know from this court's jurisprudence in other areas, you ask, can it be harmonized? Are there ways for existing law to live side by side with the new statute? If there are, then the court has a duty, an eagerly affected duty, to preserve that. If not, then we go into an argument regarding implied repeal. Now, as far as, you know, how you would describe that, what we said below was, it is impossible to predict right now how a court faced with those arguments and briefing and intervening events, all the things that could happen between now and then years in the future, we don't know where a court to come down on harmonization or implied repeal. That's what we said we didn't know. And of course, no one can know that. Even in the most obvious cases, no one can know that. If you think back to 2006, the state passed a minimum wage amendment. We had minimum wage statutes on the books at the time. It took 8 years and 4 years of litigation and a 4-3 decision by this court to determine that the constitutional amendment had impliedly repealed the minimum wage statutes. So it's impossible to expect.
Mr. Schrager, what's the point of mentioning it? Not, it doesn't mention net in the description of effect, but it does mention that current law does limit attorney fees in medical malpractice cases to 35% of any recovery. It goes on.
Yep.
Why is that even in the description of effect unless there's some interplay between them? Otherwise, why are you putting irrelevant information in the description of effect?
Well, I would take issue with the sense that it's irrelevant. I think it's contextual, and it informs the voters that this is not out of the blue. This has been done before. Obviously, what we've said in the description of effect regarding other laws, whether it's the medical malpractice cap or it's the public attorney's cap, none of that's incorrect. It's objectively true. It provides context for a signatory to understand where this is coming from. Now,
a proposed 20% cap? How does the proposed 20% cap in this initiative compare with the 35% already in medical malpractice law?
When you say compare, you mean numerically or like how it functions?
How it functions.
Well, the medical malpractice cap functions differently. Clearly, there's a different while recovery is in fact defined in the same way.
But medical malpractice is a civil action, right? So this proposed statute would cover medical malpractice cases.
Potentially, not necessarily. To a degree of certainty.
You're drafting the petition, wouldn't you want to make that clear? And make it clear to the voters who are making a decision about how those things are going to go.
I fear sometimes in these cases that with the description of effect, we neglect to consider what the description of effect's purpose is and the interplay with what the Secretary of State does for voters in explaining the pros and cons. So how does that intermix with what we're doing here?
An appropriate description of effect is meant to be accurate and anodyne. Meaning, there's not supposed to be anything in there regarding why you would vote for it or why you would vote against it. It is meant to be straightforward. It is not, all those other arguments belong to the realm of politics, right? So both in the length of the political campaign, which in this case would be almost 2 years, and in the pamphlet you're talking about, put together by the Secretary of State and drafted by proponents and opponents, which also, I might add, the Legislative Council Bureau is directed to have the very discussion about interaction with other statutes. Right? That's where that's supposed to go. There's a realm of politics, then there's the realm of what petition proponents have to put into their description in order to pass muster, right? That bar is not particularly high, and it focuses on what proponents have done. Have you misled anyone? Have you lied about what it's going to do? Have you not told the truth? Have you left something out that's so important that it's a sheer act of mendacity for you to have left it out? I submit that here, that can't be true.
If I'm a signatory and I walk away, do I believe this will apply to a medical malpractice case? If I'm signing this, what do I think I'm signing? Is a med mal a civil case such as going to be subject to a 20% cap?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that it's the material question. Was someone walking away from the petition in Helton realize that 10% of ballots under ranked choice ballot get thrown out? Or that in Washington, that it will permit abortions later in the term than under current law.
They may not have realized that the first time they voted for it, but I think they did the second time.
Which is an excellent point, which is that what this court said in two separate instances in Helton was there may be ambiguities, there may be cloudy zones within this that haven't been explained within 200 words, right? Opponents in Helton said they're not going to know what's going to happen to their votes for their third and fourth choice.
There was a single subject objection raised also.
That was the top line sort of headline out of Helton. Uh-huh. The description of effect in Helton, the discussion in Helton, was actually equally instructive, because what this court said twice in Helton was, we trust the voters to follow the process, to be able to get information and understand this. It is not the burden in the description of effect to make all those things clear. That is the burden of a political process, which will surely be undertaken here in a different way than in Helton. And in fact, the court was, as you say, Justice Turner, the court was vindicated by that because of the deliberative nature of what happened with the ranked choice voting. Here, when this is transmitted to the legislature, you know, in Helton, there was a three-month zone between when it was decided and when it went to the people. So the zone, you know, you trusted that in that zone there would be enough information and that we would trust the genius of the people to find out and make their will known. Here, it's going to go to the legislature, which can hold hearings, which can propose an alternative, and there's 2 years of political process. And one reason why the district court below, right, said, okay, thank you for all the declarations. They're not appropriate here because you've mistaken the nature of the proceedings regarding your burden and what the proponents.
Well, I want to go back to the description. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, it specifically, when it talks about when we talk about whether it's misleading or not, and it talks about medical malpractice, don't reference civil case in there. You don't use the words contingency, even though the 35% would be presumably contingent upon the recovery. So there's a lot of words you don't put in or that are not put into the description of effect when it talks about med mal and civil cases. So these are all choices that are made. It wasn't truncated. You had twice as many words to work with. And so the question is it misleading? Does somebody understand how this is going to affect even the two examples that you give in here?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, what you've just said, that it doesn't use the word contingency within that sentence. It uses...
Yes, you may finish.
It uses contingency fee in the first sentence. It says, in Nevada, most civil cases do not limit attorneys' contingent fee percentages. Current law does, however, limit attorneys' fees. I think we can presume contingency within that, and the people understand that that's part of the entire sense of that paragraph. So I don't see that there's any disconnect there that is material regarding what proponents have achieved here.
Say people can understand, do you think it just, this is more for my edification, do you think it's within the common understanding of what percentage attorneys actually do in most civil cases? I mean, this is a pretty, relative to the rest of the United States, would this be the lowest contingency fee? A cap or not? I don't know, 50-state survey before I walked in here, but I'm sure you guys have. Would it be the lowest?
I have not done that survey. I do not know whether the average person would understand what that is. Mm-hmm. I think they would know that when there's a cap, that they are probably likely to come out better than they would right now, right? Which when you want to talk about reasons to vote for or against, and someone says, well, hey, there's an attorney incentive issue, which is a reason to vote against this, and it should go into the description of effect. It's much more likely that in any contingency case, a prevailing plaintiff under this initiative would keep more money than they do right now. And that's a reason to vote for it. Neither of those are appropriate for placement in a description of fact for the reasons of politics we discussed earlier.
Any other questions, colleagues? Nope. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
Thank you. Just a few quick points in rebuttal. First, there is a 50-state survey. If you look at the Hinkle Declaration in the record, this would be by far the lowest cap in the country. No state would come close. I think after what we just heard, the path forward under this court's precedence is clear. This initiative is void, and I think the most important precedent is Education Freedom PAC versus Reed. It was decided the same day as Helton, and it explained the importance of the description of effect for voters when they're signing it at the petition phase, not for the arguments later. There's not a word about that case in my friend's brief. Let me start with the most glaring problem, which is that Uber still cannot and will not explain how its initiative works. And your honors asked some basic questions about, you know, does this apply to medical malpractice cases? How does it compare to the one existing cap for medical malpractice cases that's referenced in the description? I did not hear clear answers, and I'm actually more confused than I was when I got here about how this initiative works. And the problem is, if we can't understand how this works, how could voters possibly understand when they're asked to sign this? After multiple opportunities in the district court, in their briefing, and now today, they won't tell us why they removed that protective language for medical costs from the definition in existing law. This is not a question about implied repeal. It's just a question about what these words in this proposed initiative means and whether they're being described in a way that isn't misleading and that people will understand.
What about the argument that it's in the actual language of the proposed statute? If you read those together in its simplest form, you'll get the whole picture.
I think if you read them together, you'll be more confused because you don't know why they've removed that language. And I didn't hear a response. I think I heard that there's no change, but then I also heard that there's no explanation for why that language is omitted. I don't know what their position is. And I think this court's decisions in Reed and Helton could not be clearer on this point. You also did not hear Mr. Schrager provide any meaningful response to the detailed, unrebutted factual record, which shows, as this court emphasized in Fair Maps, Helton and Las Vegas taxpayers, shows the effects of the proposal. And the time to rebut that record was in the district court. And finally, if I may just wrap up, Uber has not responded either today or in the argument in the briefing to the central problem, which is that this initiative displaces the judiciary's power to regulate attorney's fees through the rules of professional misconduct. And under no solar tax in sanctuary cities, that is an independent failing, not a constitutional problem, but a problem with the description of effect. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.